Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, my name is Keith Brabender. Yeah, it's 10 o'clock, and I'm doing the show today on the life and death of Paul Kantner. This show is called Old and New, and my name is Keith Brabender, and I'd like to remind you I have two books on Amazon, one called A Deserted Place, and the other is called The Summit of Things. One's a novel, and one is a book of poetry. And today we're going to talk about art and society, and Paul Kantner is simply a great stepping stone to take a look at it, because we are now coming at the end of an era in which a lot of the people who had such great influence in the 1960s in rock and roll are now dying. He was 74 years old. He died Thursday. The reports are he had had a heart attack and he had had massive organ failure, and he had septic poison or sepsis. So I guess, you know, his life caught up to him in a sense. But at the same time, this generation is now, as I say, in its 70s, and many of its leading figures are dying. And the era itself is dying along with them. Excuse me. Kantner was the founder of the Jefferson Airplane. And what makes the Jefferson Airplane really important in the history of rock and roll or rock music is that they were also considered to be, at the time, the most upfront leaders of what was considered to be the musical function at that time, and that was to lead an American revolution. Now, this sounds extremely pretentious in the year 2016, that you could claim a band of people who met each other in 1965, say, in San Francisco, at a bar and decided to start a band would be the leader of a social revolution. But music was part of the great revolutionary movement of the 1960s because if you want to be philosophical about it, America had lost its religion. What this means is that if you think about the civil rights movement, for example, Martin Luther King Jr. made it into a religious movement. He was a Baptist minister. He was a minister. And it revolved around meetings at churches and prayers and singing together when you march down the street. And a lot of the American consciousness revolved around its use of religion in trying to alter society. Religion preached the idea that we were all God's children, that we're all equal, that we needed to implement a spiritual revival in the country in order to reform the evils that existed within it. And in Martin Luther King Jr.'s case, that was racism. But what Kantner and people like this did is they created a social revolution, but they didn't do it through a religious Christian outlook the way it was done by men like Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, the argument could be made that these guys or these people actually started a revolution that was deeply anti-Christian and anti-Western. They rejected the entire dualistic nature of the Western world, and what they wanted to do was to change the consciousness of individual people. That was their revolution. And it was tied to the communist revolution. So, like I said, this is very complicated. When you had the revolutions that went on all over the world, starting in the Soviet Union in the 1917 and then communist China, and then you had the Vietnam War, which was the great war between the capitalist West and the communists, and which took place in Vietnam as a staging ground. This was a revolution that was done by force and at gunpoint, and societies were changed through government and through the force of the government power. And by the time these revolutions were ended, there were a lot of corpses, and there were a lot of violence, and there was just mass murders and gulags and prisons and torturing and all of the things we hear about. And this was not supposed to be the revolution that Mr. Cantner and those of his time were leading. This was in a very real way. If you read about the lives of many of these people, they had a similarity to many of the communist revolutionaries, and that is many of them came from very middle-class families. They were raised in a kind of white suburban milieu. They lived within that context. And what they were doing is they were rejecting the 1950s Eisenhower white shirt and tie, black patent leather shoe, go to school kind of thing. And they wanted to free themselves from the restrictions of what was classified by everybody as the white bourgeois life. And in order to do this, you had to do two things to free yourself. You had to free your mind, and you had to free yourself sexually. And so the sexual revolution was tied into the same thing. The way that they attempted to free their minds was you freed your mind through the use of drugs. And this was mainly done at the time through LSD, which was quickly gotten rid of and found out to be way more dangerous than they thought. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that the drug was misused at the time. I was aware of this as a teenager because there were a lot of radio shows and talk shows about LSD in the 1960s before the government outright made it illegal. And the problem was they way overdid the dosages. And they admitted to that. They could have gotten by with, say, a 5-milligram dose, and guys were on there saying they were doing 400 and 500-milligram doses, and they were taking, some of these people said they had taken 500 and 600 trips over the course of 1 or 2 years, and we know now that this was way too much and was very deeply damaging to their brains and their nervous systems. But anyway, my point to you is this was the way in which this revolution was supposed to be done. It was supposed to be a revolution based on consciousness, a change of attitude, and a freeing of one's sexual being. Sex was no longer tied to marriage and child reproduction, and it just happened for the benefit of this movement that the pill was created, which gave women a much greater freedom to have sex and not have children. Now, within this context, what I would like to talk about is what is talked about now, 50 years later, and that is what is left of the movement and how did it fail? And was its failure actually greater than its success? And because it failed, have we ended up in many ways in the very cynical situation socially and economically that we are in now? If you want to see what I'm talking about, I saw an interview with a young lady 10 years ago or so, probably, maybe less than that. And she was talking about protesting. And because, as you know now, there are protests all over the world. There are leftist groups protesting, you know, the destruction of the Brazilian jungle, and there are people protesting in France and every European country over global warming, and there are protests in America over pipelines and all the things we see on television. There are protests constantly. And this young lady who was being interviewed on this show I saw, I was just flipping the dial. She made a comment that she had gone to the editor of a major newspaper. It could have been the New York Times, a newspaper that big. And she was telling him about protesting. And she said he looked at her very seriously and said, well, you know, we did all that in the 1960s, and now we know better. And I think that that is an attitude that can't be ignored. And the attitude is that the movement of the 1960s was deeply naive. It was from a collection of people who honestly didn't have any social understanding of what they were really doing. And what it ended up doing was what it wasn't supposed to do. And what happened to the movement was it became a business. Because once Paul Cantner and people like him created the bands of the 1960s, you know, when you had the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Then you had, you know, the really wacky side, Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, all these 1960s bands, they all signed record contracts, and eventually they ended up on television, many of them, not necessarily the Mothers of Invention, but Kantner and those people did. And they ended up becoming part of the business world, and they sold a lot of records, and they made a lot of money, and it became part of the American society. And it was integrated into the business community. And the question of the day is, how do you have a revolution that's run by a record company? What is the real intention of this, and what was the fallout from it? We ended up with a society of drug addicts, the argument could be made, and was this beneficial to society at all? Was the idea of changing one's consciousness really effective through the drugs? And what happened, and all the people, and I saw an interview with Bill Kreutzmann the other day, who's a drummer for the Grateful Dead, and he said in his interview, he just wrote a book about the Grateful Dead, he said that cocaine was just a complete disaster. It was a very, very serious social mistake. It just didn't work. The drug was just very, very destructive, and it was not anything that was beneficial to the society. And cocaine is the drug that took over from LSD. And it could actually be argued that many of the people in Paul Kantner's generation became more deeply affected by cocaine than it did by LSD, and its consciousness was actually taken to a place it didn't want to go. LSD is considered to be an egocentric drug. It's like speed. It's very destructive. It has many physical and causes much physical harm to people, particularly in your heart and other areas. And it was simply never the drug that was going to be an answer to society's problems, and for many people it ended up being very destructive, and the gangs that were created out of it were very socially destructive as well. So you have a list a list of failures here. So was there anything that the 1960s did that you could say, well, point to and say, well, you know, I'm really glad they did that. I'm really glad that this is what they did. It all worked. Things went the way they wanted to. And if you can argue that what Kantner tried to do, and even he talked about it, was that there was a supposed, we would call it the Garden of Eden period in the 1960s, and it was between the 1966-68 period, when in San Francisco they had this whole, what was called the hippie flower child movement, in which he kind of saw it, I call it the Garden of Eden period. You can call it the golden age of this hippie movement. And it was this two-year period of bliss, which was supposedly destroyed by the famous rock and roll concert of the Rolling Stones, in which the Hell's Angels were hired as the bodyguards, and they killed somebody, and it was the end of the love movement. But it was, again, very naive. There was this two-year period where supposedly all these people gathered together in the San Francisco area, and there was this free love, and they all lived together communally, and it was an equal society, and there was no competition, and there was no hatred, and everybody was, it was all wonderful. But at the same time that this community went on, we were bombing Vietnam and blowing up a country, which was seen every day on television. And the movement was supposed to be an answer to that, and that is what I would say is the other question that came up. If you listen to the songs of the 1960s, particularly a song that Kantner is really famous for writing called We Should Be Together, if you read that the lyrics to that song, it is a deeply anti-capitalist song. And anti-capitalism was still seen as one of the remnants of the 1960s movement, in which you can't escape the fact that it was seen by the right as a movement that had its ties, whether it wanted to admit it to it or not, to communism. And communism just ended up being, as I said, such a hideous bloodbath that it was hard for them to reconcile, and it only lasted a very short amount of time. But what I would say is that the anti-capitalist movement was very much a part of the 1960s movement when it was in this communal stage. And people very much forget about communes. The commune was actually seen in the 1960s as one of the fundamental answers to the competitive capitalist society of the United States. Capitalism had three great failures as it was seen in the 60s, and I was heard them all the time in my youth, as I say, on radio shows and in discussions at, you know, coffee houses and that kind of thing in the 60s. The three failures of the 1960s capitalist movement was it was destructive to the environment. It had no interest whatsoever in morality. It only wanted to sell you something, and selling you something has nothing to do with the morality of what you're buying. So in a very real way, capitalist was seen as a deeply amoral system. The object of life was to sell you something, whether that thing you bought had any value or not. And the third problem with this capitalist system was it supposedly devalued humanity because it saw everybody as a buyer and it had no interest in you as a human being. Capitalism's function is not to make you a better human being. It's to make you buy things that you don't necessarily need or want. And if you've ever seen the lyrics to Cantner's very, very famous song, We Can Be Together, he says here that this is his description of his generation. We are forces of, I'm reading directly from the lyrics. We are forces of chaos and anarchy. Everything they say we are, and we are very proud of ourselves. Tear down the walls. Everybody should be together. It says here, all your private property is target for your enemy, and your enemy is we. So that he literally has a theme here of going after private property and that it's a target of them because that is the evil of society. My point is this was a very short-lived theory. By the 1970s, after all these bands had signed their recording contracts and you saw them flying around in private jets and they were living in Beverly Hills, this was a theme for a revolution that you can argue never happened. But it did have an influence, and I would like to spend the last 10 minutes explaining what the deep-rooted influence was of this movement. What the 1960s revolutionary musical movement really did is it didn't destroy capitalism and it didn't alter society in that way. But what it did is it allowed people to believe that each individual person was capable of creating his or her own philosophy and living out his or her own way of life without a tradition. That there was no reason to believe that a specific tradition was necessary. And actually, this is one of the things that the Bolshevik Revolution was really criticized for by social commentators. I remember watching and reading books on the communist revolution of Bolshevism, and one commentator said, I remember seeing in an interview, said that what made Bolshevism such a destructive of social revolution was that the leaders of the Bolshevik Party never believed that they had any rules they had to live by. There weren't any rules at all. They had no religious tradition. They had no political tradition. There was nothing in the world that restrained them from doing anything. They could do anything they wanted. And the guy said when you told Joseph Stalin and Nikolai Lenin and Molotov that they could do anything they wanted, they just ended up butchering everybody because there was nothing to restrain them. And my point is, you can argue that this was not the same as the Bolshevik Revolution in that context, but if you read a song like We Can Be Together, it is something that you have to see. The ending of the song is, we should be together, my friends, we can be together, we will be, we must begin here and now a new continent of earth and fire. This is considered to be a very highly destructive revolution, but it's a revolution that ended up taking its place in every individual person. And if you meet somebody now who's of the current generation, who's 15 or 16, in the year 2016, you realize that there are remnants of this idea, and you see these people on television shows and YouTube who don't think that there's any tradition that they're bound by, that there isn't one, that all tradition and all concepts of social behavior are completely left up to the individual within his own consciousness to find out the answer to anything for his or herself. And they're not required to be bound by any tradition from anywhere. Now, some people would say that this has been extremely freeing for people, and it is what has liberated people from the restraints and the bounds of the past. This is what got rid of racism. This is what changed the Southern Society of America. It's what got rid of the old, Jim Crow slavery way of seeing the world. It was a new way of thinking, and it altered the entire way in which people perceive the reality. But you also have an entirely separate problem, and that is if every human being starts from scratch and has no particular tradition from which they're starting, and can reject the entire, literally, the entire 2,000-year history of the Western world, what are they basing their life on, and what are they doing? And I've actually had conversations with people who think this way. And it's a fascinating thing to talk to people like this, because they're not really bound by much of anything, and they don't think that the society should be necessarily be bound by anything. And so this is what has happened to society. There is an enormously famous painting that I saw once from France in the early 20th century. And I think it's a surrealist. I can look it up, but it's not that important. And it's a parody of the Madonna and Child, of Christ and his mother. And the parody is that Mary is spanking Jesus, and it's this painting of Mary giving Jesus a spanking. And in the painting, there are these three boys, if I remember correctly, who are looking over a wall. And the idea is that one of the boys who's looking over the wall is actually the painter. Well, the reason I raise this with you is back in the early 20th century, all of social revolution was based on the idea of the rejection of tradition. That there were people in France who were surrealists and the Dadaists and all these artists of the early 20th century, and Picasso became one of them, who rejected the traditions of the 20th century. They saw them as way too restrictive. They didn't want to be bound by this, as I say, the dualism of mind and of body and spirit. They wanted to be sexually free. And their whole movement was based on a rejection of orthodox thought. But the point would be that once you reject orthodox thought in the 1960s, and Zizek has talked about this, the new morality is there's no more orthodox thought to reject. It doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. Orthodoxy died. And Paul Kantner, you could argue, is one of the people who may have been one of the leading reasons it did die. People like him. And so now, if you can't reject orthodoxy, if it doesn't really even exist, then what is the moral basis of the society? And what Zizek, I think, very profoundly said, and I think I observed the same thing, is that the only people in the world who are considered evil now are people who make any attempt to restrict what another person can do. If anybody tells you you can't have sex with that something, in fact, I remember reading a review of a novel once in a newspaper, and it was being read by, and this kid wrote an article about it, a freshman in college, and he said the basis of the novel was it was a book about a man who had sex with trees. Now, in 1910, if you'd written a novel about a man who had sex with trees, people would have really thought that you were gone. But now, you can't tell somebody they can't have sex with trees, because this is considered the new evil. The new evil is to tell somebody they're not allowed to do something. And as Isaac said, now everything is based on this restrictive idea, because there's no traditions to reject. Everything has been pitched. And I think what we need to think about is whether or not that was truly the answer to what was considered to be the failures of the white bourgeois ethic. Because I think in many ways there was a lot of merit in parts of the white bourgeois ethic. The white bourgeois ethic in its most fundamental form was based upon discipline, self-restraint, the idea that you gave back to your community, but you also never asked to be dependent upon your community. You wanted to have a sense of independence, to take care of yourself. One of the great problems with the drug culture is it became a leech society. It fed on the society that it lived in. And the people who took drugs were and even Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones said in an interview that I saw, he quit taking heroin and cocaine, he said, because he could no longer take care of himself. He required other people to take care of him. And he said, once you reach that condition, you just simply have to stop taking them, because you can't become almost like an invalid. You have to have a certain sense of independence about yourself as a human being. You have to be autonomous. And I think that this is not, I'm not raising this because I'm giving some cranky old man bitter view of it. This was understood all the way through the movement. And I started listening to people talking about the hippie movement in 1965 when I was 10, and I heard it on the radio every day as an answer to the Vietnam complex and war and murder and destruction that went on. And this question has been asked about this movement for ever since it started in the early 1960s, or even in the Beatnik movement in the 1950s. If you look back at Burroughs and all those people from the Beat movement of the 50s. Is the answer to the Western problem to destroy every tradition the West had and then end up trying to fill it out of one's own ego and out of one's own perspective on the world individually and have no claim to any tradition whatsoever? And the only traditional claim you have is that you're claiming that you're an anarchist and that there's a tradition of anarchy within the Western world. And I don't think that mention of anarchy in the song We Can Be Together is coincidental. Because what happened is the movement of the 1960s came to a great understanding that it couldn't associate itself with Pol Pot and Mao Zedong and murdering millions of people and putting them in and having mass executions and burying millions of people in pits all over the world. And so what it did is it moved to anarchy. And there was a movement within the 1960s, and I knew people that made this claim. I had a friend of mine who made this claim, who died a couple years ago, who claimed that they weren't communists, they were anarchists, and that the answer to the American problem was anarchy. And I don't really know if anarchy was simply another cop-out, because I don't really know if that gave any answers to the problem either. But the whole time this movement went on, the entire time you had these love-ins and LSD and all the things that went on in American society, you need to be reminded that people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger were running the empire. And it's very possible that because we were all stoned at the time and we decided we didn't want anything to do with the establishment, that it actually just gave the establishment free rein to do whatever it wanted. Because in 2016, it certainly looks like Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski have been far more successful than Paul Kantner as far as how the world and how our society is organized and what has happened to it. because we are certainly living in a war machine at the moment. My time is up again, and I'd like to thank you for listening, and have a great day, and God bless. Bye.